Welcome back to this episode of the Zylab podcast, our podcast where me, Jay Schneider, and my co-host Brenda Dodd talk to you about all things legal technology, public disclosure, e-discovery, and sometimes some trivia too, as we like to get into here. So Brenda, how are you doing up in Pittsburgh?
I am cold and tired of seeing snow.
That's right. You got some snow the other night, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. I think Punxsutawney Phil was a little incorrect in saying that we were going to have an early spring.
Yes. Never trust a groundhog. but you know what? Something else that people have difficulty trusting, Brenda, is technology. And I think we're going to talk about that today. As we mentioned last time, there's a lot of buzz and hype and adoption of artificial intelligence, machine learning, technology-assisted review. And it's around us. It's everywhere. But a lot of people still don't understand it. Wouldn't you say that's right, Brenda?
Yeah, I definitely say that that is an accurate assumption, especially even on my part. Despite the fact that I work in the technology industry, I still find it somewhat difficult to understand all the different concepts that are involved with AI.
Well, then I'm glad you tuned into the show and that you're participating in it, because that's one of the things we're going to break down, not only this episode, but the next as well, because there is a lot to talk about. And I think you're right on the money that a lot of people, they're adopting the technology, they're using the tools, but we still don't understand what it is. So we're going to break down a lot of those today and also in our next episode, and really kind of dive into what these concepts are, how we can use them, how we can best leverage them, and hopefully help with the adoption, help be smarter with the technology, and also not be afraid of it as well.
I like it.
All right. Well, Brenda, let me ask you, because you've been in this field for a while, what was your first exposure to, I guess, artificial intelligence and these concepts that we're dealing with?
Well, I got to tell you, Jay, and you may laugh, but my early understanding of AI actually came from the movies. So Star Wars, Terminator, The Matrix, where it's all depicting the machines that are taking over the world or actually living with us side by side and doing everything that we typically would do in our lives. It wasn't until like 2009 when I was introduced to the concept of predictive coding by a good friend of mine that I really got to have a little bit better understanding of the capabilities and what it could do for me in the legal industry. But yeah, most of my early understanding was based on what I learned in the movies.
You know, so Brenda, I did laugh when you first said that, but then I had to pause and think, no, that's probably how most of us are. Our concepts of what these machines and computers and technology can do is a lot from whether it's science fiction. There's been a lot of great movies, maybe a few horrible ones as well. But that's probably true, and that probably leads us to maybe today, while there might be some resistance or fear people employ these technologies, or just this, I think some people also, well, it's about time. I've been seeing this in the movie for decades. And now these computers can make my job easier.
Yeah, and isn't that what it's all about? Making us more efficient and allowing us to do our jobs better.
Absolutely. And I think one of the key things that we'll be reinforcing, throughout the series and the podcast, but also today and the next time, is really talking about, we're using technology as one tool to help solve problems. But what are you using and what's the problem you're trying to solve? So really, there's a lot of application for artificial intelligence, for machine learning, to manage your data. And we're going to be talking about that. But before we talk about how to apply that and what the best practices are, we really need to dig down into what it is. There's a lot of confusion with all the terms. There's a lot of misunderstanding about the concepts, what it is. And so we want to make sure we cut through that, break that down, and then we can get on to, all right, now how do we actually use this, and when is the good time to use this? So that's what we're going to be talking about today. But before we get into that, Brenda, I love me some good trivia.
I do know that, Jay.
And I know you do as well.
I absolutely do.
And I'm glad you mentioned the movies because conveniently, my first trivia question for you, Brenda, yes, I'm going to ask you the question, has to do with a movie. Are you ready?
I am ready.
In the 1983 cinematic classic War Games, machine learning played a central role. Which game did Joshua, or Whopper, first play against itself until it learned the futility of nuclear war? And I've got four choices for you, Brenda. A is chess, B, tic-tac-toe, C, Go, D, global thermal nuclear war.
You said this was in 1983.
1983.
I think
Matthew Broderick, Ally
Sheedy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you say that, but Matthew Broderick and Ally Sheedy were probably in all movies around that time, right?
This is true. Well, this movie took place in Seattle, my hometown.
I think I vaguely remember it. So my choices again were Chess, Tic Tac Toe, Go, which I'm not even sure what Go is, to be honest with you, Jay. And global thermonuclear war. I'm going to go with that one because it sounds like it would be the appropriate answer.
It sounds like it, but actually you are incorrect. But that's okay. You can rewatch the movie. The answer was B, tic-tac-toe. So let me tell you, in the pivotal scene towards the end of the movie, where the Joshua, Whopper, had been taken over the nuclear systems and was, everyone thought this threat that launched the missiles were going to launch at any moment. Matthew Broderick's character actually started playing tic-tac-toe against Joshua. And then he set the number of players to zero, and Joshua started playing it. So now, Brenda, what happens when you play tic-tac-toe?
Well, it depends on who I'm playing. sometimes I win, but most of the time it probably ends in a tie.
Okay, so for a lot of people, tic-tac-toe will end in a tie. So what happened is Joshua played itself, and it played itself repeatedly again and again and again, and it kept ending in a tie. It then took that and started playing simulations of its other game, Global Thermonuclear War, and also realized that the outcome ended with no winner. But it was able to learn from that and decide that the games weren't worth playing and averted nuclear war, and we got through the 80s all alive. But what I loved about that movie, and I rewatched it recently, which is why I wrote this question. So I have two boys, and I love to share things from my childhood, so I was glad they're at an age where I thought they would find this movie interesting. Of course, as I'm watching it, looking at all the retro, there's a phone booth that plays a critical moment. I don't even know if there's many payphones around anymore. It had a video arcade, and I'm looking at all these sort of nostalgia pieces, but I realized the concepts of machine learning and artificial intelligence are very real, and it was not sci-fi. Again, this is exactly what's happening today. But some of the fears that they had of putting computers in charge of the missiles, are these same fears we have today of, do we really want technology in charge of things? I will pause to say it was not Joshua's fault. He is not the villain in the story, but there was some misuse of technology, and everybody went out okay. So, but anyways, 1983, War Games, artificial intelligence, machine learning, these concepts have been around for a long time. We're just seeing them applied more today, finally.
Jay, I'm thinking about the tic-tac-toe. Now, if I were playing against myself, I'd always win.
All right, so Brenda, I've got some more trivia questions, but I don't want you to answer these. These are for our audience, and if you don't know the answers, or if you know the answers, you can shout them out in your car or your office or cubicle, wherever you are. If you don't know the answers, that's fine, because if you keep listening, you might find the answers later in the show. So, Brenda, are you ready?
I am.
Next question, number two. What was the name of the computer system or program that beat Garry Kasparov in chess? I've got another one, question number three. What was the name of IBM's computer system that won at the game of Jeopardy?
Jay, that's a little easy. I think I know that one.
All right, well, we'll save your answer till the end. And number four, what was the name of DeepMind's program which beat Lee Sedol in Go? And Brenda, Go is a game. We'll explain it later how that one's played, but it's also a strategy game. What was the name of DeepMind's program which beat Lee Sedol at Go? So we've got some names of systems that have been developed, or programs, or computers, machines, whatever we want to call them, and listen for those as we go throughout the show. But let's get into our topic. And though Brenda and I love to chat, and we had the pleasure of being able to speak with the Xilab chairman and chief strategy officer, Jan. And so we were able to record that conversation and get a lot of information from him.
Yeah, that's right. Jan is a very interesting fellow, and I think that our listeners are going to appreciate what he has to offer on this subject.
Well, we'll take you to that conversation now.
For those of you who are not familiar with Xilab's Chairman and Chief Strategy Officer, let me introduce to you Johannes, or Jan, Schultes.
Yes. Hello, Brenda. Hello, Jay. Thank you for inviting me in this podcast. So I've been with Xylab for almost my entire professional career, which is now almost 30 years. I am at Xylab, I'm officially the chairman, and I'm the chief strategy officer. I work most in the data science team these days, which is the team at Xylab that is figuring out how we can apply artificial intelligence methods and algorithms and data science methods and algorithms and make the whole process of discovery, public records requests, answering regulatory requests, internal investigations, etc., more efficient and more automated. So at the end of the day, the goal is to do it better, faster, smarter, and more cost-effective. In addition, I am a full professor at text mining, which is a form of artificial intelligence focused on searching very large and analyzing very large data sets, mostly of textual nature. And I am, since 2 years now, 1.5 years, the president of the ASETS Benelux chapter. That's the Association of Certified E-Discovery Specialists. And we spend a lot of time and effort in evangelizing the benefit of e-discovery technology in the Benelux, which is actually the countries of the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg. Which is also where the European Commission is based. So there's a lot of e-discovery here as well. So that's it.
Well, great. We're excited to have you on the call today. And we're even more excited because we want to talk about AI and machine learning. So a lot of terms and jargons get thrown around these days, whether it's TAR, AI, machine learning. Jan, can you tell us, are they different? Are they related? Are they the same? Give us a little bit of background on these.
Yeah. Well, it's actually, the answer is all of the above. There's a lot of these terms are marketing terms. They're created and invented by companies to create a unique marketing term in an effort to make the market believe they have something which is truly unique, and there's no other company that can do what they can do. That's where the terms predictive coding, technology assisted review, TAR, continuous active learning, machine assisted review, and a lot of other terms all come from. From a scientific point of view, the whole field of artificial intelligence is kind of an umbrella term which incorporates, among other terms, also machine learning. It also incorporates natural language processing, text analysis. It also incorporates robotics, export systems, all kind of audiovisual efforts to actually use human forms of perception and teach it to a computer, like speech recognition or speech generation. And from all of those, the most interesting and which come closest to the marketing terms are in fact machine learning, which is applied to natural language, and that's used to classify documents based on their content, and to automatically identify responsive documents, or to analyze documents so it's easier to detect privileged documents, or to do all kind of additional analysis. That's like the relationship between TAR, artificial intelligence, machine learning, text mining, and natural language processing.
So Jay, let's stop and digest some of what Jan just said, because that definitely was a lot to take in.
Yes, let's digest some of that.
Okay, so based on what the average person thinks or what they think they know about AI, at least, you know, from what they've seen in movies or what they may have heard, coupled with all these terms that we just heard, and even if they are just marketing ploys, you can't help but see why there's some confusion or hesitation, especially in the legal community, to adopt these types of technologies. So how can someone like myself, who doesn't have a degree in cognitive science or artificial intelligence, how am I supposed to make sense of all of it?
And that's really, that's a good question. That's really kind of the point of what we're going through. So as someone with a degree in cognitive science and artificial intelligence, I will say artificial intelligence, that's this sort of umbrella. It's actually a branch of computer science. And we're seeing this every day in terms of, you know, self-driving cars. You're talking to Alexa and it's responding to you with a lot of really cool things that are happening now. In the realm of how we're applying that in, say, e-discovery or public records or investigations with data. So artificial intelligence is, again, trying to help the machines, trying to help the humans do things that humans had previously done or typically do. We're really looking at, and this, and Jan mentioned this, machine learning to identify documents, classify documents, and learn in that way. So if we're talking about a practical application, probably the best way is saying, yes, it's AI, that's a huge umbrella. Specifically, we're probably more in the realm of machine learning, where the machines are learning to classify documents that we're looking at. We're classifying something as responsive or privileged or relevant to a specific issue, and the system is learning what that means so it can help us in classifying the other documents. Those are kind of the big pieces. Other terms that were mentioned, Brenda, because I've got some more. So in our field of e-discovery, you hear about TAR, technology assisted review. If we look at that at its simple definition, it's just technology assisting us in our review. So that's pretty simple. However, it gets more complicated as you get protocols of TAR 1.0 and 2.0. And really, the takeaway there is, when people first started really embracing this idea of TAR and artificial intelligence or machine learning, there was an older protocol where you had to go through a lot of hoops and train a system in a certain way and have experts involved. We don't need to do that anymore. So we've got this more TAR 2.0, where there's more active feedback and continuous ranking of documents. There's even a TAR 3.0. Those are iterations. But here's the thing, Brenda. You don't go and buy TAR. You don't go buy a TAR 1.0 product and TAR 2.0 product. You might have products that are following certain approaches or methods or algorithms. But at the end of the day, what you're looking for is a tool to get the job done. And it's probably going to help you get the job done with some type of AI and machine learning that's going to help learn what you're doing and then help you get your job done faster, smarter, and the rest. Brenda, I just said a lot. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. So basically, what you're saying is the terms that we are commonly hearing here in the legal community, TAR and assisted review, those are really just protocols or methods that utilize this intelligent technology. And you notice, Jay, I didn't say artificial technology or intelligence.
I did notice you say that, yes.
Because for some, I think that that term alone may be where the problem lies.
Absolutely. So, I mean, and again, I can go back to my degree in this, where I studied cognitive science and the actual philosophical differences. Are machines actually thinking? Do they have consciousness? Is this really learning, or is it just a pattern? So we're not going to get into that debate right now, but you bring up a good point that there's a lot of these terms that can just confuse us. And Brenda, we do have a white paper. Xilab has a white paper that can help define some of these terms. So we'll let you all off the hook and we won't define them all now. But if you want more information, where can they go, Brenda?
They can go to Xilab.com and to our resources page. So there's plenty of white papers.
I believe it's called What's in a Name?
Thank you.
I couldn't
remember
you out.
The name, but what's in a name?
My own true intelligence helping you out there. So at any rate, there's a number of terms, but don't get hung up on the terms. Understand that there's a lot of things going on to try and help you, and we're getting this progress, this evolution as we move forward with more powerful technology. There's another related field and a related term, and I think Jan gets into that next. So let's go ahead and listen to what he has to say about data science.
The term data science is a term that's also used a lot in combination with artificial intelligence, which is in fact also an umbrella term. Data science is can be stated it's like a fancy word for what we used to call statistics. Or probabilistic technology, or which is actually just mathematics, a form of mathematics. And data science focuses on this particular form of statistics where large data sets are analyzed, data sets that are derived from real world situations and that are used to automatically derive statistical models to find certain patterns that can then be applied to automate certain tasks. So artificial intelligence is more an umbrella term from computer science, focused on teaching computers how to do typical human tasks. Data science is more like a mathematical term, which is used to describe a variety of statistical patterns and methods to analyze data and then also automate typical human behavior based on those statistics.
Okay, Jay, let me see if I understand this data science.
Okay.
From what I heard and what registered in my mind, data science is designed to find or analyze patterns in electronic data. So in other words, it can quickly and more accurately better help us to better understand the whos, the whats, the wheres, the whens, the whys associated within that data. So basically, I guess data science, when it's coupled with AI, is really about making sense of the data, which then will allow us to make better decisions or allow the computer to make better decisions for us. Is that correct?
Brenda, I like how you put that together. A couple of things that I think are very good about the way you frame that. So data science as is just studying data. I mean, really, that it's just studying data. What can we learn from a massive amount of information? I like how Jan almost dismissively said, "Oh, it's just a fancy word for statistics and probability, analysis." But really, that's true. The field of data science by itself is just, studying data and what we can learn from it. Coupling that with artificial intelligence, and really when we get to machine learning, so we're taking all that data, the machines are able to analyze and process far more than we can with these massive amounts of data, and then actually, and you might see my fingers doing air quotes, learn, so you can decide the philosophical of what's learning and not learning, it can actually gain more information from all that data, and that's where we're able to benefit. So, we have the situations where if a machines are helping us review documents and it's able to learn from a lot of data, it might be able to learn what we do. It might also be able to point out things that we ourselves as brilliant humans couldn't recognize ourselves because we weren't able to process that. So yeah, data science, it's a science, an area all in itself. However, that intersection of coming under artificial intelligence and being able to take all that data and then, as you said, make decisions or really learn from that and maybe make decisions or even make predictions based on that.
So Jay, you just talked about machine learning, and that was something else, another area that we talked to Jan about. So let's listen in and see what Jan had to say. I know in the e-discovery field, we talk a lot about TAR and CAL and machine learning. So for the non-technical listener, how does machine learning actually work?
Yeah, machine learning, there's different types of machine learning. You can very roughly separate three different approaches. The most popular one is a supervised machine learning approach, which in which what we do is we provide samples of data with particular labels that describe the content of that data. And then by showing the computer enough samples, it can learn to automatically classify other non-classified samples at a later moment in time. So it's supervised because you provide the data plus the classification it belongs to a computer system. There's also another approach which is called unsupervised. And unsupervised is also called clustering or topic modeling or concept search, which are other scientific terms for different slight variations of the same approach. And with unsupervised learning, the data figures out itself which labels it belongs to. So it compares itself with other data samples, and then it figures out where it belongs best, in which group and which cluster. And then yeah, you can then determine which label to assign to these clusters. It could be like the label of the most dominant or the most common denominator. And that's another way of machine learning. In general, unsupervised machine learning is less accurate than supervised machine learning. Unsupervised machine learning is also called concept search in e-discovery. And then there's a third approach, which is actually the combination of these two. It's called reinforcement learning, which is very similar to how human beings learn. And it's also very similar to how we teach at a university. You provide a couple of samples to a student, and the students learn from these samples, labeled samples. And then you have smart students who will figure it out by self-organization, and then as a teacher you reinforce them. So if they do something right, you reward them. If they do something wrong, you well, we can no longer punish them, but then we tell them what they did wrong. And then by giving them this reinforcement, the students actually learn very quickly, and at a certain moment in time, they can all figure it out themselves. And this is a very popular learning algorithm that has been extremely successful recently in artificial intelligence.
So Jay, here are my thoughts on what Jan just said.
Okay, I'd love to hear them.
Well, maybe.
Okay, all right. I reserve the right to love or hate hearing them. Go.
Well, you reserve the right to allow me to learn in my own way. How about that? So to me, it sounds like machine learning is a lot like teaching a child in many ways. Okay, so you have the supervised learning, where to me it's like the parent is teaching or coaching the child as to what is right or wrong. You know, as parents, it seems as though we're always applying a tag. In other words, we're always saying yes if it's right or no if they're wrong, just like we would do if we were tagging a document for responsiveness. Yes, it's responsive. No, it's not. Whereas the unsupervised learning is where the child is simply learning by observing its surroundings and noticing how certain things just seem to fit or go together. So for example, my grandson, he doesn't really know his colors right now. So he doesn't know that red is red and blue is blue. But yet I've seen him when he's playing and he's grouped his blocks, you know, regardless of the fact that they're different shapes and sizes. He was capable of putting all the red blocks together because to him, that just, I guess he knew that they were similar or they had something in common. So to me, that's similar to like an unsupervised learning process. Whereas the reinforcement learning is basically similar to rewarding the child for doing what we expect them to do, or giving my dog treats every time she does something that I want her to do. So Jay, am I way off base in how I see machine learning?
Well, this actually, Brenda, is a great example of some reinforcement learning, because you're presenting something to me, and now I get to give you that feedback into whether it's on the right track. So I like a lot of what you said. Of course, any analogy is only as good until it falls apart.
My analogy fell apart?
No, I'm saying
you're reinforcing my learning.
I'm reinforcing your learning. So the examples you gave up, exactly. So in a supervised situation with machines, we are maybe looking at a document saying this is responsive, this is relevant to an issue, you know, whatever decision making, and the system is looking at how we are classifying documents and learning so it can also classify those documents. But it's limited to that scope of what we're teaching it. If you're teaching it on, you know, a specific issue, it knows nothing about any other issue if it hasn't been trained on it. So there it's a very narrow scope, and it's a human intervention teaching machine. So to the beginning of your example, when you talked about a parent teaching a child, absolutely, that's an element where you're teaching a child, say, you know, names of colors. That is something that you're probably explicitly teaching a label, saying this is red, this is blue, this is red, this is blue. When you talked about the unsupervised learning, so there a machine is just looking at the data and looking for patterns and grouping things together. These are similar. These are not similar. We see this in concept models or topic models that we have in our softwares. We look at data. And so, yes, exactly right. Your grandchild might be looking at blocks and just making observations and saying, I think, you know, these red blocks are similar, these blue blocks are similar. So that's definitely an aspect of unsupervised learning. And machines do it, and we learn a lot from it. Humans can do that as well. The reason I was saying the analogy goes only so far is those are specific examples. But in fact, reinforcement learning that Jan talked about last, that's probably most human-like because it's a combination. So as your grandchild is naturally learning about the world, unprompted from humans, is maybe noticing certain blocks are larger or smaller or shapes and there, that is an aspect of unsupervised learning. But you as the adult might go in, and when the child raises to you a block and says, this is red, and you say, no, actually that's orange. And, you know, then you start giving that feedback and maybe showing some more nuance or more detailed information. So, but yes, I if it works for you, Brenda, go with it. The supervised versus unsupervised learning. I think definitely training the dogs is a great example. Sometimes people talk about reinforcement learning as just trial and error and then getting feedback, as we're going to hear in in a bit. That's how some games or compute systems learned how to play themselves with a game. Jan's going to talk about that shortly. It's also how when you're training a dog, often it just goes on about the world by doing what it does, and then it gets that reinforcement, good or bad, a treat or punishment, and then it learns, oh, I should or should not behave this way.
Okay.
Does that make sense, Brenda?
It does. Okay. And I know that I have a lot more to learn, and I'm looking forward to our continued conversations.
We will continually learn. Your ability to classify and identify these terms will get better and better over time.
I'm never going to say that I'm as smart as a machine learning process, but I will work on it. In the meantime, I do want to bring Jan back in one last time before we say goodbye to our audience. As you know, during our conversation with him, we asked about significant developments in the field of AI and how we got to where we are today. So let's listen in and see.
Yeah. No. Well, what we've seen over the years in artificial intelligence and is an evolution. An evolution from a moment where we explicitly had to write an algorithm and teach that to a computer. A good example is in 1997, Kasparov, world champion chess, was beaten by Deep Blue, a computer chess program developed by IBM, which contained the knowledge of computer chess specialists, which was explicitly programmed in algorithms for more than 30, 40 years. This was a very successful program, but it was not really artificial intelligence, because the computer did not learn it itself. It was, everything it had to do was written out by humans. In 2011, IBM again won the game of Jeopardy with Watson. And again, this was not really artificial intelligence. It was a fancy computer setup. The computer could speak and listen and understand. But it was not truly artificial intelligence in a way that the computer thought itself. It was no more than a 4 terabyte textual database with a smart information retrieval system on it, with some smart program that allowed it to find the answers to the, or actually found the questions to the answers. That's the way how Jeopardy works. And beat the human contenders with flying colors. In 2016, there was a major breakthrough in artificial intelligence, and this was with when Google, who took over the initiative in AI from IBM, where Google taught a computer system how to play Go. And 10 years before anybody expected it, this computer system beat first the European champion and then the world champion. And there's a great Netflix documentary called AlphaGo. And if you want to learn more, you can. It's really, really great to see it and to watch it and to learn more about artificial intelligence. Now, this system only understood the basic rules of Go. And everything else it learned by itself. There were, of course, about 40,000 games from professional players, which the system was bootstrapped with. And then it played at the level of an average amateur. But then they let the computer play against itself for about 30 million times, and more than any number of Go games any human can play in its entire life. And they used the principles of reinforcement learning, where the reinforcement was implemented in a very simple, straightforward way. If you win, you do something right. If you lose, you do something wrong. After 30 million games, the computer was able to beat the world champion. What Google did afterwards, it even improved that system. It took out the fact that that the system was trained and bootstrapped with that 40,000 games from professional Go spielers, and it started all the way from scratch without any human knowledge, nothing, and it learned how to play Go in the most efficient and profound efficient way. After again playing a lot of games against itself, that system actually beat the original algorithm which beat the world champion by 100-0, which was amazing, because it actually means that our human knowledge is probably only in the way of such a computer system, and the computer becomes much better in playing Go if it's not being hindered by the human knowledge. Google then did the same by teaching that computer program also chess. And in just under 4 hours, the computer teaches itself how to play chess and then beat the best performing computer chess algorithm by also something like 67-34. And you can ask yourself, why is it not 100-0? That's because with chess you have remise, or equal, which is something that doesn't exist in Go. So that's the reason why. So, but you could also say it's like 34-0. Now, those were amazing breakthroughs because the computer taught itself everything. There was very little human effort involved, and this is what we now also see with in the field of artificial intelligence and e-discovery, where initially the computer is taught by humans. And the computer is now more and more also learning to figure out things itself, to organize data in certain ways that are very similar in different e-discovery cases. It learns from dealing with these e-discovery cases. But one of the things where we are focusing a lot of effort at Xilab is to also teach the computer how to detect anomalies, how to detect what's wrong, what's odd, what doesn't fit, and use that also in more efficient fact-finding missions to provide better priority setting for users in very large data analysis.
Jay, considering your background, none of this is probably news to you, but I found it fascinating, especially to hear Jan say that human knowledge or human beings may actually hinder AI. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so that is really interesting to say there. And first of all, I'll say that there are a few key takeaways from what Jan said. The first takeaway, for those of you following along at home, is you may have found some of the answers to our trivia questions in what Jan said, but we'll get to that in a minute. But as Jan talked about these kind of milestone events and achievements, as we look at this human versus machine struggle, whether it's the myth or fear of a sci-fi movie or the realities as we're having machines assist us or even perform tasks and compete with us. So it's interesting, as the examples he talked about, IBM's Deep Blue beating Garry Kasparov in chess, and how that was, you know, that machine beating human at a game of chess. That was a significant event. You have an example decades later where IBM's Watson beat humans at a game of Jeopardy. And then you have more recently where Google, who owns DeepMind's AlphaGo program was able to beat Lee Sedol in Go, in a game of Go, a strategy game that's even many more times infinitely complex than chess. What I found interesting was, so when we had a machine that could beat a human at chess, that was done in a way where the machine was programmed. So it had to know all the conditions and the logic and explicit rules on how to play the game, how to, you know, if the board looks a certain way, you know, what moves to make, probability of other items played. So there was a lot of rules. We see this in e-discovery too. Initially, when you're trying to find a responsive document, you know, in the earlier systems, you're doing keyword searches. Why? Because you figure, well, maybe if the document contains a specific word, it's responsive to what I'm looking for. So really, we just use keyword searches saying, if this word is present, that might be responsive. So that was sort of our rule following. When IBM won at Jeopardy, when Watson won at Jeopardy, and I need to mention, remember, Brenda, when we were at Legal Week the other month, when we had that speaker who was on the Watson team? He was the keynote speaker on day two.
Oh, that's right. He was great. Right.
But when that was happening, that was also an impressive achievement in humans versus machines. But even then, it was still just a massive database of information, a lot of facts, a lot of knowledge in there, and it was very impressive. It could interact with humans. That was another area of AI that's quite fun, and robotics and all of that. But at the same time, it wasn't necessarily learning or thinking. It was had a massive database of information. Fast forward to just a few years ago when DeepMind's AlphaGo beat Lee Sedol in a game of Go, beat a human. What was impressive about this is that the program was taught the rules and taught how to play. Then it would play itself, or it would play humans and learn from that. And so this is where we get into more of this machine learning, this concept of learning where it's not all explicitly taught and just rule following. And again, if I go back to the e-discovery, as you know, we might have been keyword searches, then we might have been more nuanced and sophisticated with all the rules and if-then and ways we could search. But at the end, it was still many rules-based to find the documents we were looking for. Now it's gone a step beyond that, where there's a bit of intelligence, there's a bit of understanding, and I'm using that in quotes to not get into a philosophical discussion here. Where a system can make better decisions and go beyond the scope of what is explicitly told. So that's what we're really seeing now. We're seeing that in e-discovery and our products now of how they learn about how we're discovering responsive documents. And we're finding that you know, our system can find documents that were responsive and a human will go, yep, that was responsive, but the human wouldn't have been able to find using these, you know, traditional methods of finding it, and they're finding more and more accurate results. But Brenda, going on to what you just meant, that humans can sometimes get in the way, what was amazing about AlphaGo are also AlphaGo Z, its successor, is that with AlphaGo Z, it was self-taught. The programmers did not teach the system how to play Go, it just started playing, and then through that reinforcement learning, it lost a lot. You know, it made a move, lost, made a move, lost. And it eventually figured out or learned how to win. So here it was not taught by a human, it was taught by itself, by this reinforcement learning, and was able to learn how to play. And Brenda, getting your point, which is a great spot to end it before we get into trivia, is this idea that sometimes when a human teaches a machine how to do something, it is also teaching the same human biases or human restrictions that we have. There was a move that the machine played, that AlphaGo played, that no human would ever have played. Every human watching said that was a mistake, that was a horrible move. It turned out to be a brilliant move, and no human probably would have come to the conclusion that it was a good move to make. So we're seeing a lot of exciting things, and I've gotten way beyond the scope of e-discovery here, Brenda. Apologies to everybody in the audience. But as you say, sometimes it's good to let the machine do what it does best and for us to get out of the way.
I definitely agree, and I'm looking forward to our next session or podcast where we talk about what are we talking about, Jay?
Well, we are going to continue on about in this topic, but we're not going to get so philosophical and controversial. We're going to come down to how do we actually apply some of these best practices? What does this actually mean? So if I'm an investigator, a public records disclosure officer, or I'm working on an e-discovery case, how can I actually apply this? What does it mean? What are some of the challenges? When are situations where I actually AI is not my friend or is not the way to use? And really, how we can best leverage this exciting technology, and to be honest, how not to be afraid of it.
I'm really looking forward to it, as I said, and I believe we're also going to have Jan back to participate in that conversation as well.
Yes, but Brenda, before we actually sign off, real quickly, I just went through the answers in my recap to you. But just to be clear, trivia question number 2, what was the name of the computer system that beat Garry Kasparov in chess? That was Deep Blue. What was the name of IBM's computer system that won at Jeopardy? That was Watson. That's the one you knew. That's the one you're so excited to get, Brenda. And finally, what was the name of Google's DeepMind program that beat Lee Sedol in Go? That was AlphaGo. Also the name of a great documentary. I highly recommend it. I believe our Benelux chapter, of which Jan is a chairman, they had a showing of that last year for those in the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Belgium.
Oh, yeah, the ACEDS Benelux chapter. That's correct.
All right. Well, with that, thank you for enjoying my ramblings, Brenda. It's been a pleasure chatting with you about this. We will be doing this again shortly, continuing our conversation with Jan. Thank you all for listening and joining, and we will see you next time on the Xilab podcast.
Thanks, everyone. Take care. Goodbye.
Bye.